content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine.
Careers in government and in healthcare, not to mention in our own households. These barriers are even more insurmountable for the poor and for women of color. And then there's parenting. Why do women end up having to mother not just their own kids, but sometimes, it seems, everyone around them? And yet, through the struggles, there's great joy and great community, especially when we celebrate each other by sharing our stories and wisdom, which is why we put together this assemblage of books to empower women. This list of empowering books is tailored for women who are seeking a wide range of insight into a variety of topics, including dating struggles, moving through the world as a transgender woman, ethnic identity, disability, artistic roadblocks, domestic violence, breaking into the boys' club that is the comedy world, bias at the workplace, or validation that being an introvert is actually pretty cool. Mostly memoirs by incredible women, these authors are Nobel Prize winners, iconic creatives, passionate activists, and whip-smart experts in their field. They have a wealth of knowledge that will make anyone feel validated and help make you feel truly seen. And for a bonus treat, we included a journal. So break out those glitter pens and colorful markers. Power on. Number 1, Uncomfortable Labels by Laura Kate Dale. The labels others choose for us so rarely reflect who we actually are. In this groundbreaking memoir, Dale explores the labels that have influenced her life as a gay trans woman on the autism spectrum. She takes readers on her journey through transition, diagnosis, and discovering who she truly is by challenging assumptions of society. Candid and humorous, this memoir is a reflection on gender and autism and what it means to live authentically. Number 2, Revolution from Within by Gloria Steinem. A fierce feminist, Steinem has been at the front lines of social revolution for decades. Now, as we face reproductive rights being stripped away in the U.S. on a mass scale, her wisdom on revolution has never been more timely. Injustice can erode our internal sense of power and self-confidence, and here the activist and icon shares how we can reach within to restore the inner fire that outside forces have tried to extinguish. Changing the world means harnessing our power externally and internally, and when we do that, we can change the course of entire nations. Number 3, Yoke by Jessamine Stanley. In Sanskrit, yoga means to yoke. It means the connection and flow of our minds and bodies, our movement and breath, and the good and the bad of life. Yoga is so often seen as just something we do for exercise, but it's more than that. It's about yoking, connecting, the lessons learned on the mat to who we are off the mat. A memoir and essays, Stanley reflects on cannabis, why self-love is a full-time job, and why we need to address the whiteness that has overtaken Western yoga. Growing up Baha'i, Stanley shows readers how these questions of spirituality have been a core part of her life, and what you can learn from it too. Number 4, I Am Malala by Malala Yousafzai and Christina Lamb. When Malala Yousafzai was 11, she wrote blogs for the BBC documenting her days in school in the Swat Valley, Pakistan, where the Taliban was gaining control and banning girls from receiving an education. The youngest Nobel Peace Prize winner at 17, she survived being shot by the Taliban and valiantly continued to raise her voice to advocate for girls' rights to education. Her remarkable story is a reminder of the inner power we all have to stand up to oppression against women and girls everywhere. Number 5, The Source of Self-Regard by Toni Morrison. Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison was a genius. Her power with words approached the supernatural. In this collection of essays and meditations, Morrison weighs in with her extraordinary oratory and literary power on a variety of topics, among them a spine-tingling prayer for the dead of 9/11, her eulogy for James Baldwin, and her thoughts on the role of the artist in times of political turmoil. She also explores the subject of female empowerment and interrogates the concept of womanhood itself. The Source of Self-Regard will pull you in like a siren. You'll never forget the lessons it imparts. Number 6, She Means Well by Quinta Brunson. Brunson has taken the world by storm with her hilarious and tender new show, Abbott Elementary, nominated for 7 Emmys, which she created and stars in. Before the Emmy-nominated show, the comedian got her start creating viral comedy videos on Instagram and YouTube, which developed into stardom as she got roles on HBO, Netflix, and Comedy Central. In her funny and deeply personal collection of essays, Brunson delves into her brand of online humor, what it feels like to try to be successful even when you're struggling, and why it's important to stick to your roots. Number 7, In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado. Machado's revolutionary and innovative gothic memoir about domestic abuse is a work of epic talent. In it, she interweaves myth and cultural analysis alongside her own searing dreamlike recollections to construct a portrait of what it is to be queer and in an abusive relationship, a subject long ignored by even some of the most vociferous domestic violence survivor advocates. Machado uses legal proceedings, fairy tales, Star Trek, and Disney villains to create one of the best memoirs in recent memory. Number 8, Well-Read Black Girl by Glory Edom. Nominated for an NAACP Image Award, this enthralling anthology will give you greater insight into the magic of entering new worlds and learning from text. The volume features essays by some of the best Black women authors and icons out there, Jesmyn Ward, Tayeri Jones, Gabourey Sidibe, and Jacqueline Woodson, and is curated by the founder of the wildly popular book club Well-Read Black Girl. Number 9, You Are Not a Before Picture by Alex Light. Diet culture is toxic, often causing women to put their health at risk in order to achieve the coveted after picture look. But You Are Not a Before Picture confronts this harmful preoccupation and encourages women to accept and love their bodies. Well-known Instagram influencer Alex Light consults experts in psychotherapy, fitness, and nutrition to create a framework for finally saying to ourselves, yes, I like you just as you are. Number 10, In the Company of Women by Grace Bonney. Is there any better feeling than being in a room filled with inspiring, successful women? In the Company of Women captures that feeling so you can keep it close by on your bookshelf. The volume features over 100 entrepreneurial women of all ages, ethnic backgrounds, and careers who've overcome barriers to become experts in their fields and offer firsthand accounts, for example, of what it's like to be a celebrated tattoo artist or an iconic architect. Use it as a guide on your journey to becoming an assertive leader in both your professional and personal lives. Number 11, Knocking Myself Up by Michelle T. How many of us were raised to associate motherhood with being a wife, or with being straight, fairly young, or financially well off? If you don't fit that mold, T's vivid memoir provides an inspirational, hilarious, and down-to-earth alternative portrait. In it, the author-poet, tarot legend, and 2021 Guggenheim Fellow shares her intimate story of deciding as a 40-year-old, single, queer, uninsured woman to have a child. Number 12, Fairest by Meredith Toulousan. A finalist for the 2021 Lambda Literary Award for Transgender Nonfiction, Toulousan's gorgeously written memoir explores her childhood as a boy with albinism growing up in the Philippines, her immigration to America, where she transitioned, and navigating the elite world of Harvard, which awarded her an academic scholarship. Toulousan explores themes of race, dislocation, disability, and gender with insight and power, a true classic. Number 13, Year of the Tiger by Alice Wong. In Chinese culture, the tiger is deeply revered for its confidence, passion, ambition, and ferocity. This is a spirit that Wong, founder and director of the Disability Visibility Project, carries into every battle on behalf of disabled people as an activist, media maker, and community organizer. Drawing on a collection of original essays, previously published work, conversations, graphics, photos, and art by disabled and Asian American artists, she shares her reflections on creativity, access, power, care, the pandemic, mortality, and the future. Number 14, Quiet by Susan Cain. As women, we face so much pressure to be the life of the party, to engage and entertain everyone. And even when people are trying to empower us, that advice is usually to be louder, more aggressive, to take up more space. Not all of us want to be on all the time, But the pressure to be extroverted can leave you doubting yourself and unaware of the power of introversion. In this New York Times bestseller, Susan Cain, whose viral TED Talk tackles those myths about introverts, shares how you can use your introverted spirit to your advantage. She writes that introverts tend to be more perceptive, observational, and objective, making them effective at innovation and out-of-the-box thinking. Being quiet isn't something you have to apologize for. It could just be your superpower. Number 15, Heart Berries by Therese Marie Malhot. The best-selling poetic memoir chronicles an Indigenous woman's experience of childhood dysfunction, mental illness, troubled romance, and motherhood. The author's struggle to come to terms with a stint in a psychiatric hospital and a dual diagnosis of PTSD and bipolar II disorder is rendered so powerfully that the reader feels they are there with her, cheering her on. Through hazy memories that still retain a startling clarity, we also see Malhot reflecting on her relationship with her father, an abusive drunk and a brilliant artist, who was murdered under mysterious circumstances. Altogether enthralling. Number 16, The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin. What does it mean to be truly, deeply, blissfully happy? We all know we want to attain this kind of happiness, but in a world of long work hours, impossible expectations, and global uncertainty, how do we achieve it? For Rubin, it started with realizing just how much of her life she was wasting by not focusing on her own well-being. So for a year, she decided to focus solely on that. Throughout, she shares her own thoughts and experiences, as well as scientific research and life lessons from others, providing a roadmap to enlightenment and fun. Number 17, Wildflower by Drew Barrymore. A child actor thrust into the spotlight early, Barrymore's story is full of trauma and struggles with addiction, but ultimately a tale of triumph despite many roadblocks. Cheerful and honest, the actor, mogul, and TV host shares with readers her journey to adulthood and how she reconciled with her past to become the woman she is today. Our next article by Stephanie Farrington is titled, "The Founder of the Op-Ed Project Set Out to Amplify Marginalized Voices in the Opinion Pages." Long before Katie Orenstein founded the Op-Ed Project, a social venture, part social business and part nonprofit, dedicated to uplifting and amplifying historically marginalized voices in the media, she harbored a sensitivity to the silences imposed on certain groups of people. I grew up constantly thinking about who we were listening to and who we weren't listening to because of the dynamics I saw around me in my family, my community, and my school, says Orenstein, who's also the author of Little Red Riding Hood Uncloaked, Sex, Morality, and the Evolution of a Fairy Tale. As an undergraduate at Harvard in the late 80s and early 90s, Orenstein decided to study folklore to learn how story is created and by whom, a critical inquiry because, as she often says, the story we tell becomes the world we live in. While studying, she came across folklorist Zora Neale Hurston's book, Tell My Horse, about her time collecting stories and revising history in Haiti and Jamaica, and thought, that's what I want to do with my life. She became a voracious reader of Hurston's work and eventually applied for a grant that allowed her to fly to Jamaica and Haiti to start her new life, and similarly immerse herself in the culture to gather meaningful stories. When she arrived in Haiti, a coup broke out. So I started writing about what was happening in the streets, she says, which involved a gruesome litany of horrors. Rape, torture, murder, arson, massacres, assassinations. In 1992, Orenstein had a formative experience that magnified the importance of who tells the story. While reporting out a story on the 100,000 Haitians who marched across the Brooklyn Bridge on October 11th of that year, she noticed that while they were protesting the coup in Haiti, some took aim at the New York Times, accusing the newspaper of being the voice of the State Department. She wondered if they could be right. Even in the pre-internet era, she says, she was easily able to track down the key sources the Times used to build its story. International and American diplomats, elites, and very few majority-class Haitians, she remembers, emphasizing how flagrantly these sources biased the Times' reportage. You can imagine how all that threads up for me, she says. By 2005, Orenstein, now living back in the States, became absorbed in several conversations about women's lack of representation in various fields that dominated the media at the time, planting the seed that would soon form the basis of the Op-Ed Project. First, former president of Harvard University, Lawrence H. Summers, gave a speech in which he wondered whether a lack of biological aptitude might explain the dearth of women in the sciences and engineering. Then columnist and political pundit Susan Estrich accused the Los Angeles Times of sexism due to the fact that so few women's bylines ran on the op-ed pages. To attach real data to Estrich's charge, Ornstein conducted her own inquiry with pragmatic zeal and aptitude for research and found, more broadly, that women comprised only 15% of the expert voices on our country's most influential platforms between 2007 and 2008. Part of the problem, she found, was that men were submitting far more unsolicited opinion pieces than women, up to 90% more. The single greatest predictor of who gets published is who pitches, she says. What if we stopped wringing our hands and debating and just jumped in and tried to do something, Ornstein thought. As someone whose words often showed up in the nation's leading opinion pages, the New York Times and the Washington Post, among others, she knew the basic steps as well as the huge potential for impact in publishing think pieces and decided she'd start conducting workshops throughout New York City. Let me show you the components of a pitch and how to write an op-ed, she thought. It occurred to her that someone ought to start an organization dedicated to the cause. She traveled circles large and small to find a willing founder. When the Times ran a piece about her in 2007, she started to wonder if perhaps she should take the reins. I thought, since no one else is doing it and someone should do it, gosh, maybe it should be me. Why not me and why not now? By 2008, she'd established the Op-Ed Project with the goal of expanding and magnifying a diverse array of voices, especially women's voices, and succeeded beyond expectation. By 2012, that 15% climbed to 21%, a 40% increase. Using a database called Media Cloud, an open source platform for media analysis in partnership with MIT, she calculated that the representation of women's voice on our country's most authoritative platforms moved up to 26% by 2015, a staggering 73% increase. While many forces contributed to this shift, the proliferation of social media and publishing platforms, the hashtag MeToo and Black Lives Matter movements have all driven a richer range of voices into the media landscape. The Op-Ed Project's impact is undeniable. Today, 20,000 people, overwhelmingly women from a vast and diverse range of backgrounds and expertise, have directly benefited from the org's workshops as well as its mentorship and fellowship programs, and hundreds of millions have benefited indirectly from the spread of their ideas. In keeping with its core values, the Op-Ed Project's resources are open to people of all identities and regardless of means. A virtual two-day Right to Change the World workshop taught by seasoned journalists costs $450 with full or partial scholarships for up to 30% of each workshop's participants. The class includes a month of access to journalist mentors, which will be extended free of charge for an additional 2 months to participants who utilize its service. Every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the Op-Ed Project hosts Ask a Journalist Office Hours, where an editor reviews work submitted by members to break down its strengths and limitations from which the group can learn. In addition, the Op-Ed Project also runs a portfolio of fellowships that bring together diverse thinkers across industries and disciplines with critical expertise that can help solve big challenges, like the climate crisis, public health problems, racial injustice, and the advancement of women's rights. According to research conducted by the University of Colorado, scholars' visibility in mainstream media increased by 240% after doing the organization's Public Voices Fellowship within 2 years compared to 2 years prior. Carol Anderson, Ph.D., a historian at Emory University, is a prime example. The well-established academic, who chairs the African American Studies Department, placed an op-ed in the Washington Post while in the fellowship program titled "Ferguson Isn't About Black Rage Against Cops. It's about white rage against progress." It went viral and eventually became the basis for her New York Times best-selling and National Book Award-winning book, White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. It was read aloud on the Senate floor. "She's become one of the most important public thinkers and historians about race in our generation," Ornstein says, pointing out that it's not just hard data the Op-Ed Project collects to demonstrate its efficacy, but public impact, too. Another thinker who impactfully passed through the organization is Zarina Grual, whose op-ed in the Times, "When War Comes Close to Home," described a drone strike in Iraq that killed members of her own family. The op-ed forced several countries and the U.S. Pentagon to acknowledge civilian casualties. Human rights workers and journalists investigated, and 5 years later, the first survivor was granted reparations in August 2020. Sylvia Foti, a workshop attendee in the mentorship program, wrote an op-ed in Salon about discovering that her grandfather, Jonas Noreika, formerly thought of as a war hero, was actually a Nazi collaborator responsible for the deaths of thousands of Jewish people. Her research resulted in front-page coverage in The Times and a book, The Nazi's Granddaughter, all of which caused a huge stir in Lithuania, galvanizing local historians and citizens to demand a plaque celebrating his life and heroism be removed. While these exceptional women demonstrate the power of words to reshape the world, a key measure of the project's efficacy, Orenstein says, her organization also gauges success based on participants' personal transformations, sharing a quote from a student in a recent workshop. "What you offer is professional development at its highest form. The term professional development fails to do justice. I so rarely feel nurtured and strengthened in the way you and your team made me feel last week. I feel recharged from being around you. I learned deeply from you. I seldom encounter people like you. You're extraordinary in your uplifting of others." While she recognizes the systemic impediments that prevent many of us from believing in our own capabilities and thwarting our efforts to advance a cause or idea, she says, "I want us to be clear-sighted and not close our eyes to that, nor let it be an excuse for inaction. A key moment for me was when I crossed the street from thinking someone else should do something about this issue to thinking I should," she explains. Musing on the op-ed project's driving purpose today, she says, "In this moment in time, when I think about what's best for us and what's going on around us, we want to be a counterforce to regressive narratives, unethical information, fake news, and false and exclusionary hierarchies of knowledge. We see ourselves as a standard bearer for a more ethical and inclusive conversation in history." Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, "How the Royal Family Actually Makes Their Money." When she passed away on September 8, 2022, Queen Elizabeth II had a sizable net worth. Questions about how the royal family makes their money have circled for years. They're often spurred on by moments like when Prince Harry and Meghan Markle announced their official exit as senior members of The Firm. There's also Season 3, Episode 4 of The Crown, where Tobias Menzies, Prince Philip, gives an interview to NBC's Meet the Press. In it, he addresses the royal's rumored money problems and the fact that the Queen hasn't had a pay raise in almost 18 years. This interview actually took place in November 1969, 2 years after his mother, Princess Alice, moved into Buckingham Palace. In the Real Life program, host Lawrence Spivak cited a London News report and said to Philip, "It goes on to detail the very high costs that the royal family must sustain on an allowance of $1,100,000 a year. Is that creating an awkward situation?" "Very," Prince Philip, who died on April 9, 2021, replied. "We go into the red next year." As to whether they'd had to shutter any of their estates, Philip said, "No, not altogether. We've closed down. Well, for instance, the Queen had a small yacht that she had to sell, and I should probably have to give up polo fairly soon." At the time, Philip's remarks provoked ill will from the British public, who failed to share his view that selling a yacht counts as a financial hardship. The royal family's salaries had last made headlines in November 2019, following unconfirmed reports that Prince Andrew, Queen Elizabeth's second youngest son, would forgo his annual payment of roughly $300,000 after stepping back from public duties for the foreseeable future amid a cloud of scandal. So what are the royal family's salaries? How do they earn them, and where does the money come from? What was the Queen's net worth before her death, and how are Meghan and Harry making money now? Here's what we know, including how these funds cost the average taxpayer in England. How much does Britain pay the royal family? As with most things royals related, the answer is complicated. The royal family is paid through a mix of public and private money. That's on top of net worths that include inherited wealth, a significant real estate portfolio, and other assets. Before her death, most of Queen Elizabeth II's family's annual income and expenses were paid through three sources: the public sovereign grant and the private duchies of Cornwall and Lancaster. The sovereign grant. Since 2012, the monarch's official duties and the costs involved in maintaining the occupied palaces have been paid for by a government-administered annual lump sum called the Sovereign Grant. According to the British monarchy's official site, funding for the Sovereign Grant comes from a percentage of the profits of the Crown Estate revenue. The Crown Estate, as CNN Money explains, can be roughly defined as a collection of UK properties and farms that generate hundreds of millions of pounds each year. These lands were first surrendered by George III back in 1760 to be managed by the Treasury going forward. The Crown Estate technically belongs to the reigning monarch, but as their site clarifies, it is not the private property of the monarch. It cannot be sold by the monarch, nor do revenues from it belong to the monarch. It's presently overseen by an independent organization's board. In the 2018-2019 fiscal year, the total sovereign grant amount was £82.2 million. That's nearly $106 million in American dollars. Neither the Queen nor her family were raking that total in, though. £32.9 million of that were allotted for resurfacing of Buckingham Palace, and it also covered the royal family's duty-related travel expenses, payroll, other staff costs, and literally keeping the lights on. The Sovereign Grant replaced the civil list and three grants in aid for travel, communications, and palace maintenance. Until it was abolished in 2012, the civil list was an annual amount the government used to give the Queen to cover her duties as head of state and head of the Commonwealth, and grants and aid from government departments that previously paid for royal duty-related travel and upkeep of royal residencies. The Privy Purse and the Duchy of Lancaster. If the Sovereign Grant is an expense account of sorts, the Privy Purse includes the monarch's actual income. Their estates are also considered included in the Privy Purse. The monarch's income is drawn from the Duchy of Lancaster, which is a portfolio of land, property, and assets held in trust for the reigning sovereign. In 2018, the Privy Purse received nearly £20 million, about $26 million U.S. dollars, in income from the Duchy of Lancaster. While the monarch uses part of this money to cover additional expenses, Elizabeth also drew from it to pay her children, Prince Andrew, Prince Edward, and Princess Anne, a salary for their schedule of royal engagements around the world. When Prince Andrew stepped away from his public duties in 2019, it wasn't immediately clear whether he was still receiving any funds from his mother, the Queen. British tabloid The Daily Express claimed that he is, per an unnamed source, but Buckingham Palace did not confirm. The Duchy of Cornwall. Established in 1137, the private estate funds the public, charitable, and private activities of the Prince of Wales and his family, its site says. It consists of land and properties in 23 English counties and a portfolio of investments. When he was Prince of Wales, Charles and his wife, Camilla Parker Bowles, received their income from the Duchy of Cornwall, 90%, according to CNN Money. He paid Prince William and Kate Middleton, and formerly Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, through revenue surplus from the Duchy of Cornwall. His siblings, Princess Anne, Prince Andrew, and Prince Edward, are paid through the Duchy of Lancaster. In the 2019-2020 fiscal year, Charles and Camilla received nearly £22.2 million, about $30 million American dollars, in income from the Duchy of Cornwall, and almost £2 million of funding from the Sovereign Grant allotted to subsidize their official royal activities. The majority of staff and official and charitable work, including the official offices of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and the Duke and Duchess of Sussex activity, are paid for from His Royal Highness's private income from the Duchy of Cornwall, their annual review states. In the 2018-2019 fiscal year, Charles and Camilla undertook 638 social engagements in 14 countries. From 2019 to 2020, they undertook 580 engagements in the UK and abroad. The Queen's net worth fell in 2020. It may surprise you to know that while the Queen was the richest member of the royal family, she wasn't a billionaire. In 2020, the Queen's net worth reportedly dipped by £20 million from the previous year, according to the annual Sunday Times Rich List. The paper valued her net worth at £350 million, or roughly $486 million U.S. dollars. In 2019, Forbes had assessed the Queen's net worth as equal to at least $500 million U.S. dollars. Per the Crown Estate's annual report for 2019-20, the value of the British royal land portfolio fell by 1.2% to £13.4 billion in 2020 due to the COVID-19 lockdown impacting tourism and retail in particular. By reports, Her Majesty was notoriously frugal. Newspapers are shredded for horse bedding, parcel string is reused, frayed sheets and dusters are darned, the Sunday Times writes in regard to Buckingham Palace housekeeping. Harry and Meghan were cut off and live off his inheritance from Princess Diana. In the January 2020 announcement of their intention to step back from royal duties, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle stated a desire to work to become financially independent. In September 2020, Newsweek confirmed that Prince Harry was no longer receiving funds via the Duchy of Cornwall. That same month, the couple also announced that they'd paid back the $2.4 million in public money taken from the sovereign grant that was used to renovate their Windsor home, Frogmore Cottage. But in their sit-down interview with Oprah, Harry and Meghan revealed they'd actually stopped being paid in the first quarter of 2020, much earlier than discussions about their departure had led them to believe. "My family literally cut me off financially, and I had to afford security for us," Harry said, voicing concerns for their son Archie's safety without the security detail the royal family had revoked. Harry said they'd been living off his share of the inheritance his mother, Princess Diana, left to him and his brother William after her death in 1997. According to The Independent, after taxes, the half that Harry received upon turning 25 amounts to around $13 million. "Without that, we wouldn't have been able to do this," Harry said, suggesting their move to a new home in California was made possible thanks to those funds. Harry and Meghan inked what's believed to be a very lucrative Netflix deal, estimated to be worth between $100 and $240 million in U.S. dollars. The streaming platform hasn't confirmed a sum. They also produce a podcast and a deal with Spotify, and Oprah and Harry produced a docuseries on mental health for Apple TV+. In August 2022, Markle launched her own podcast, Archetypes. Initially, the Netflix and the Spotify of it all weren't part of the plan, Harry told Oprah in the interview. These revenue streams are in addition to Markle's own money from her previous career as an actress. In her days on the USA drama Suits, she earned a reported salary of about $450,000 in addition to endorsements and related income. While it's an unconfirmed number, a February 2020 Forbes report estimated Harry and Meghan's net worth at about $10 million. Castles, stocks, and stamps. The monarch has assets. Before her death, Elizabeth had a personal portfolio of investments and a sweet stamp collection, and also inherited Balmoral and Sandringham estates from her father. The Queen couldn't hawk a tiara or two if times got tough, however. She didn't technically own the crown jewels, the royal residences, or most of the royal art collections. In the event of her death, those were passed on to the next sovereign, King Charles. And again, any income that trickles down to Elizabeth's children and grandchildren from the duchies is on top of their own inherited wealth. Does the monarch pay taxes? Before her death, the Queen voluntarily paid income tax and capital gains tax since 1992. Any income received from the Duchy of Lancaster that doesn't go to official expenses was taxed as well. She was subject to value-added tax also, voluntarily paid local taxes. What does paying the royals cost British taxpayers? Out of pocket? Honestly, not much. Collectively, that is. In 2018, it cost each average British taxpayer about 65 pence a year, according to Fast Company. So less than a dollar. Even with the cost spiking by 41% in 2019, per Business Insider, the individual taxpayer still pays cup of coffee money, an artisanal organic cup of coffee. Our next article by Monica Sean and Cassie Hurwitz is titled "Everything to Know About Joe Biden's Grandchildren." President Joe Biden is no stranger to the national spotlight, having been in politics from the age of 29 when he was first elected to the Senate. Since he's been in office again, the country has gotten to know his family better, including his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, as well as his children, Hunter Biden, the late Beau Biden, and Ashley Biden. But when talking about the Biden family tree, it's important to remember his grandchildren. The 79-year-old politician is in constant communication with them. "Every single day I speak to all five of my grandkids, either on the phone or I text with them," Biden told Anderson Cooper during a CNN town hall, noting that his late son Beau's children live close enough to stop by and chat. We sit on our back porch and they sit out on the lawn with the two chairs there, and we talk about everything that is going on in their day and talk about being home from school and who's driving whom crazy and so on. President Biden's grandchildren include Hunter's four children, Naomi, 28, Finnegan, 22, Maisie, 21, and Beau, 2, as well as the children of the late Beau Biden, Natalie, 18, and Robert Hunter Biden II, 16. Now the Biden family is gearing up for a White House wedding. Naomi will marry her fiancé this November on the South Lawn, as Naomi announced on Twitter in July of this year. If these names look familiar to you, there's a good reason why. Five of President Biden's grandchildren, Naomi, Finnegan, Maisie, Natalie, and Robert Hunter, participated in the 2020 election, including kicking off the first night of the virtual Democratic National Convention by reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. On the final night of the convention, the four granddaughters appeared in a segment discussing how much their grandfather likes ice cream. They treated him to a pint the day he officially accepted his nomination, and how they encouraged him to join the 2020 presidential race. That support from his grandchildren eventually paid off as Biden was sworn in as the 46th president on January 20, 2021. Although he's busy leading the country from the White House, Biden still has ways of keeping tabs on his beloved grandchildren. In a Today Show interview with Jenna Bush Hager, Maisie confirmed that their pop does indeed call regularly. That's something that I feel like some people don't believe when we say that he literally calls, not just like one of us every few days, she said. He calls me, then calls Naomi, then he calls Finn, then he calls Natalie, then he calls Ashley, and then he calls little Hunter. Even when they don't pick up, Natalie said, their grandfather stays in touch through their big group chat. According to Maisie, after all of us may have rejected his call on a day where we're all busy, he texts us, just tried calling you guys, missed it, love you. Here's what we know about the Biden grandchildren. Naomi Biden. Born in 1993, Naomi is the oldest of the Biden grandchildren and the first child of Hunter and his ex-wife Kathleen. Naomi is named after her late aunt, who died at the age of one in a car accident in 1971 that also killed Joe Biden's first wife, Nelia. In 2016, Naomi graduated from the University of Pennsylvania's School of Arts and Sciences with a bachelor's degree in the same class as Tiffany Trump. After college, she went on to get a degree from Columbia Law School, graduating in May 2020 in a virtual ceremony where her grandfather was the guest speaker. Since January 2021, she's worked as an associate at the D.C. office of the international law firm Arnold & Porter. Naomi is no stranger to the national spotlight, having accompanied her grandfather on numerous trips while he was vice president. She's also hung out courtside with President Barack Obama. In September 2021, Naomi announced that she was engaged to her longtime boyfriend, Peter Neal, a University of Pennsylvania law student. Forever love, Naomi captioned a photo of her and her new fiancé. Their White House wedding venue was confirmed in earlier this summer with Naomi's Twitter announcement. Much to the relief of Secret Service and with the dog's endorsement, we'll be getting married on the South Lawn. Couldn't be more excited, she wrote. On Instagram, Naomi hinted at their wedding date with an I Do countdown, posting a picture of the South Lawn on July 28th with the caption, 114 days till we do. We did the math for you. That places their wedding on November 18th, 2022. She also posted what appeared to be a bridal shower, including snaps from the day with her youngest sister, Maisie, plus her mother and maternal grandmother. Finnegan Biden. Although Finnegan's Instagram page is private, she does make appearances in her older sister's profile. The second daughter of Hunter and Kathleen, Finnegan was born in 2000 and is named after her great-grandmother, Catherine Eugenia Jean Finnegan Biden. She maintains a relatively low public profile, but has previously hit the campaign trail for Biden. Finnegan also attended the University of Pennsylvania, just like her older sister. Maisie Biden. Hunter and Kathleen Biden's youngest child, Maisie, was born in 2001 and is close in age to Sasha Obama. According to the Chicago Tribune, the two became fast friends and even attended the private Sidwell Friends School in Washington, D.C. together. Her best friend is Sasha Obama, said Biden, who skipped an event during his primary campaign to watch his granddaughter as well as Sasha graduate from high school. Barack and Jill and the whole family, we had a whole get-together. She also has a talent for basketball. Maisie's a real athlete. I mean, for real, Biden said about his granddaughter's skills on the court, the Chicago Tribune reports. Maisie frequently posts videos on her TikTok, which has more than 170,000 followers. Natalie Biden. The oldest child of the late Beau Biden and his widow Hallie, Natalie made several appearances during a video segment that played during the virtual 2020 Democratic National Convention, including one where she helped introduce her grandmother Jill. "I would say she's not your average grandmother," Natalie said, laughing. "She's a prankster. She's very mischievous." Natalie was just a toddler when Biden first became vice president, and she grew up in the spotlight, often photographed with her doting grandfather. Robert Hunter Biden II. Hunter, Beau's second child with Hallie, was born in 2006. The young teenager doesn't have any public social media accounts, but he has made several appearances alongside his famous grandfather. In 2008, he was photographed in Biden's arms as he accepted the vice presidential nomination. In 2020, Hunter appeared in a video with the other grandchildren reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Beau Biden. Born in March 2020, Beau Biden is the son of Hunter and his wife Melissa Cohen. Named after his late uncle, the youngest Biden grandchild was present at the January 20, 2021 inauguration at the U.S. Capitol and was later photographed in his grandfather's arms on the Truman balcony of the White House. When Beau turned two, Naomi shared new photos of him on her Instagram, calling him the love of her life. Our next article is titled, "A Breakdown Almost Cost This Entrepreneur Everything." Here's how he came back from the edge. In his early 20s, Andy Dunn received a diagnosis of bipolar disorder after a frightening manic episode in college. For years afterward, he dealt with unspeakable shame but didn't deal with the diagnosis. At the same time, he was building a widely successful business. As the co-founder of Bonobos, a digitally native, direct-to-consumer menswear brand, Dunn raised millions of dollars and found that many of the traits that brought him success as a founder, relentless drive, mega confidence, and intense ambition, were the very same that fed into a dangerous mental health spiral. More than a decade after his first manic episode, Dunn experienced another. It resulted in hospitalization, and upon release, he was arrested for being violent during his episode, something he hadn't even remembered because of the state he was in. This time, Dunn did not ignore the reality of his bipolar disorder. With the help of his now wife, Dunn focused on learning how to prioritize his mental health. In his new book, Burn Rate, Launching a Startup and Losing My Mind, Dunn shares his story and speaks to the importance of making the workplace a safe space for those navigating mental health struggles. To talk about all this and more, Dunn sat down with Oprah Daily contributor Lynn Saladino, PsyD, who is a therapist in New York City. Check out their enlightening conversation below. I wanted to start by asking you what your goal was for the book. My first goal was to normalize disclosure about mental illness, particularly at work. People value stability in the business community because there is money at stake. Data shows that around 3% of the general population has a mood disorder, and that index is potentially 7-1 in entrepreneurs. We are over-indexing in the startup community. The book was a chance to normalize this conversation. I've had the benefit of having built a company and sold it, and in theory, have the financial independence of my disclosure not holding me back. When I was like, "Hey, I have bipolar disorder," no one was shocked. The details may have shocked them, but not the diagnosis, because they had worked for or with me. They knew I was a mercurial leader. The second, more selfish reason was that I had felt ashamed for so long. It felt like a human stain on me. Even the way it's referred to by some people, someone is bipolar rather than has bipolar. Someone isn't cancer, they have cancer. It's a heavy diagnosis to take on. In my family and group of friends, we didn't talk about it. I didn't really talk about it at work, so there was shame. I wanted to be able to expunge and metabolize that shame. I know of several heads of startups that have had to be hospitalized for mental health conditions and needed to hide it. What do you think needs to happen so people can stop hiding this kind of thing at work? I think we need disclosure pathways at a company so that people can disclose what's going on to an outside person if they'd like to. There needs to be resources available before a crisis occurs so that you can get the coaching and counseling needed on how to approach it in the workplace. Whether it's a boss or HR leader, people need to be trained to be accepting and affirming when someone comes to them. You have to let them know it's not going to impede their career. You have to do that right away in the conversation because it's a terrifying thing to disclose. When someone is faced with a diagnosis, there's often a grief process that occurs, one that comes with the realization that you have to take care of yourself in different ways. As a therapist, I can say that I've seen having a label help some people and really throws others. In the book, it seemed that the diagnosis you received after your first break was downplayed by several professionals along the way. How important was a concrete diagnosis to you? A diagnosis, depending on what it is, can hit you like a sledgehammer. Bipolar disorder is tricky because it implies you're going to be living in two poles. It can build instability into your self-perception. A lot of people will say to me, "My daughter is bipolar," and I say, "Good news, she's not. She has bipolar." The 16-year gap between my diagnosis and accepting it was too long. I think the question is, how do we shorten that window to 6 weeks? How do we get people to a place of acceptance? I was able to eventually get to a place with my diagnosis where it was helpful to realize I'd be taking medication every day. At first that was hard, but then my view changed. I was able to appreciate that science has allowed for medication that can help me. Absolutely. Beyond the diagnosis, it's about the conversation that is had. Throughout your book, I noticed the piece about acceptance, realizing that substance use has to be watched, that sleep and eating are important. If someone is not experiencing bipolar disorder, they can miss a night of sleep without too much consequence. That's not necessarily true for someone who has bipolar. The struggle can be even more challenging when someone gets diagnosed young. They aren't ready to adjust their lifestyle and live differently than their peers, so it didn't surprise me that it took you time to get to that place of acceptance. Your sister was a big support to you throughout your journey. Being someone who has supported my own sister through mental health challenges, I found that I really empathized with her. What advice would you give to a family member who is supporting someone struggling? The first thing that comes to mind is that if you are a family member of someone going through this, you are probably going to need help and support yourself. If you want to be strong for someone else who is in crisis, you can't ignore your own mental health. It's the idea of securing your own air mask before helping the person next to you. Then I think there's acceptance and accountability. What I loved about the way my family responded was that it wasn't just, "We accept this and everything will be fine." It was, "We accept this and you have to do this stuff to take care of yourself." There was accountability. What has been your experience supporting your sister? I agree that it's about being as supportive as you can, but also knowing that you have to take care of yourself. It's a delicate balance when it's someone you love so much. All you want to do is be there for them. At the same time, if they aren't taking care of themselves at a very basic level, it's hard to know how to be there for them. The other day, I heard someone call it a mental health stack, and it is a stack. At the bottom of the pyramid is sleep. It is so important. No one can save me if I stop sleeping. But also, if my sleep creeps up, it creates awareness for me that I'm moving into a depressive phase. So I pay close attention to sleep. My doctor and medication are next, side by side, and then I think it's transparency about my mood. With my wife in particular, it's about not hiding my sadness, anger, or any emotion. Naming those things is important. Our next article by Isabel Burton is titled, "Surprising Ways Mushrooms Can Benefit Your Health and Wellness." Unless you've been living under a rock or in a cave, or perhaps especially if you have been, you've likely been seeing mushrooms popping up all over the culinary world. They're making appearances in coffee, chocolate, and protein bars, and being ground into health powders to add to your smoothie. Experts in the nutrition world are putting them at the top of their superfood lists. And while mushrooms have served important roles in ancient wellness rituals and protocols dating back thousands of years, researchers have found evidence of mushrooms in the human diet as early as the Stone Age, they're coming back under the scientific spotlight, being newly researched and appreciated for the profound body benefits they seem to deliver. And there are a lot. To name a few, enhanced immunity, improved gut health, protection against cancer, and cellular activity that keeps you feeling and looking younger. One meta-analysis published in Advances in Nutrition confirmed that higher mushroom consumption is associated with a lower risk of cancer. Another new study out of Penn State University found that large amounts of two antioxidants, ergothionine and glutathione, give mushrooms the power to fight the free radicals that cause age-related diseases. And yet more research published in PubMed Central discovered that a component in mushrooms called terpenes stimulates the activity of immune cells, meaning they bolster your natural ability to fight viruses. What's going on behind the scenes to induce these health benefits is complicated, multifaceted, and not entirely understood yet. But broadly speaking, we can thank the plant chemicals and compounds, namely polyphenols, polysaccharides, indoles, carotenoids, and a unique type of fiber called beta-glucans, for executing antioxidant, anti-cancer, and anti-inflammatory effects, according to research published in Molecules and Biomedical Journal. And then there's gut health, which is proving to be the infrastructure for all health. Consuming mushrooms may help populate your GI tract with the right balance of bacteria to keep it healthy and strengthen your immune system, states a review in International Journal of Molecular Sciences. Polysaccharides, abundant carbohydrates, and fungi not only spur the growth of healthy bacteria, but also manage to survive traveling through stomach acid, when other foods break down, to reach the colon and go to work there where they're needed. While scientific evidence shows that fungi go a long way in improving your overall health, experts are discovering that mushrooms optimize some more surprising specific areas of your life. The best mushroom for every wellness need. Mushrooms, and there are over a million different types, fall under the category of adaptogens, each offering something a little special and unique, explains Taro Escapula, a functional mushroom expert with a certificate in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University, who was raised growing and foraging mushrooms on his 13th generation family's farm in Finland. Escapula so believes in the power of mushrooms to improve well-being that he's devoted his life to the fungi, creating Four Sigmatic, a brand of mushroom, adaptogenic coffees, and other products to upgrade the routines of anyone and everyone. Adaptogens protect your body from stress by stabilizing and optimizing a host of physiological functions, he says. This causes a domino effect that leads to better physical vigor, improved brain functioning, and an uptick in mental health. According to Escapula, who has twice been named one of the world's top 50 food activists by the Academy of Culinary Nutrition, we can actually target areas of our well-being by consuming certain types of functional mushrooms. Lion's mane is a type of functional mushroom that specifically supports creativity, productivity, and focus, says Escapula. We like to call this mushroom your brain's best friend. The results are seen with continued long-term use, which is why adding it powdered to daily staples like coffee and chocolate is a good plan. To break it down, certain compounds in lion's mane may stimulate the production of nerve growth factor, NGF, fine science, which regenerates and protects the neurons in our brain tissue, material that starts to decay with age. According to a multitude of studies, NGF has been shown to increase cognitive function, leading to sharper focus, memory, intelligence, and awareness. And when it comes to improving mood, Penn State researchers found that in a sample of almost 25,000 people, those who regularly ate mushrooms, a variety of types, had a lower risk for depression and anxiety. The authors believe it may be the work of the antioxidant ergothionine. The cordyceps mushroom has been linked to improve athletic performance, energy, stamina, and higher immune function, says Escapula. Cordyceps is great to take first thing in the morning as a supplement or before your workout to help you get fired up. Pharmacological research shows these fungi can increase production of ATP, the compounds that give cells energy, and two studies found they improved exercise performance in healthy older adults, which explains why they're the new secret weapon for athletes. What's more, the mushroom helps oxygenate blood cells, improving metabolic rates and helping muscles recover, especially after an intense workout. Another trial found that cordyceps acted like a hormone balancer, increasing levels of endurance and energy in those struggling with fatigue. Adaptogenic mushrooms nourish the body from the inside out. Amazingly, humans share roughly 85% of our RNA and 50% of our DNA with mushrooms. That's right, you and I are part mushroom. So naturally, they play a role in total body beauty and wellness, says Escapula. The diverse range of phytochemicals and ample amounts of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and other key nutrients make mushrooms a valuable resource for truly glowing from the inside out. But he warns topical products rarely have enough potency, so these are shrooms you want to consume. Three types that stand out as the greatest workhorses, tremella, shaga, and shiitake. Tremella behaves like hyaluronic acid by drawing and locking in moisture. It can hold an amazing 500 times its weight in water to the skin, making it smooth and supple. Shaga is full of antioxidants that protect skin against the oxidative stress responsible for signs of aging, like wrinkles. Add to that the ability to control inflammation, their antimicrobial properties, and an extremely high level of melanin, and their natural skin protectants. Shiitakes are known to decrease activity of what's called elastase, basically the enemy of elastin, a protein that helps your skin stay plump and bouncy. They don't stop there. The shrooms have properties that accelerate cell renewal, plus they're full of an amino acid that reduces damage from UV light. And then there's reishi, the queen of mushrooms, which earned this moniker because of how it supports the body's stress response and generally revitalizes the body, says Issa Kapila. Reishi is native to China, Japan, Vietnam, and Korea, but grows all around the world. It has been used in traditional Chinese medicine for over 2,000 years, making it possibly the oldest known mushroom to be used medicinally. Because it reduces anxiety and tells your body to chill, it's one of the best ways to naturally prepare for restful sleep. Body's stress response and generally revitalizes the body, says Issa Kapila. Reishi is native to China, Japan, Vietnam, and Korea, but grows all around the world. It has been used in traditional Chinese medicine for over 2,000 years, making it possibly the oldest known mushroom to be used medicinally. Because it reduces anxiety and tells your body to chill, it's one of the best ways to naturally prepare for restful sleep.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.